Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, Deborah Solomon tells us about an unusual new biography of Vincent van Gogh.
The book is, I thought, very negative in the sense that it wants us to believe that van Gogh had an anger management problem and basically spent his life acting out.
Gina Belafonte is here with an update on the Big City Book Club. The Times' legal correspondent, John Schwartz, tells us about the joy of audiobooks.
I get a lot more pages read through my ears than through my eyes these days, though I always have a book going as well.
And Gregory Coles has bestseller news. Vincent van Gogh remains not only one of the world's great artists, but one of the most enigmatic and romantic culture figures of modern times. There's a huge new biography. It's called Van Gogh, The Life. It's by Stephen Naifa and Gregory White Smith, and it's reviewed for us by one of our favorite art reviewers, Deborah Solomon, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And now, how is Van Gogh doing? Under the careful, almost 1,000-page attentions of these two authors, what do they have to tell us about this singular figure?
First of all, I noticed the book is called Van Gogh, The Life, as opposed to A Life. I'm wondering, what do you think of that as a biographer? Do you think that's a little bit territorial? The Life, as if there's not room for anyone else's life.
Well, they think they've got the answer, do they?
The book is, I thought, very negative in the sense that it wants us to believe that Van Gogh had an anger management problem and basically spent his life acting out in order to annoy the people around him. And his every action from working in charcoal as opposed to color to painting peasants and people who were not well off to consorting with Catholics, that you may not have known about, everything he does is seen as somehow an affront to his father, a deliberate affront to his conventional parents.
And who were his conventional parents?
He grew up in a parsonage in Holland, and his father was a parson, the parson Van Gogh, who seems actually to have been fairly progressive. One problem with the book is that when you read, you feel an enormous disjunction or disconnect, to use the word of the moment, between the incredible sensitivity of Van Gogh's letters and the obnoxious drunk who emerges from this book. They make him out to be, he's like Charlie Sheen in this book. He's just this guy who was always angry, delusional about his abilities, and goes around taking advantage of people. They also accuse him of being extravagant, which I found was the strangest claim.
Extravagant how?
Extravagant because he is, of course, an icon of the penniless artist who subsisted on breadcrumbs and slept on the floor. So they accuse him. They constantly say he was so extravagant. You would think that he owned vineyards in France from the way they talk about him. He did spend a lot on art supplies. He did spend a lot, and he was spending borrowed money. He was spending his brother's money. I don't think that counts as extravagant. I think if you're an artist, especially if you're the greatest Dutch artist who ever lived after Rembrandt, you're entitled to buy yourself paint. Really good quality paint. I'm glad he spent on his paint, because if he hadn't, all the paintings would be cracked now if he had used lesser quality paints.
Do they have anything to say about his art? Now, they wrote a big book on Jackson Pollock,
right,
which in some ways is kind of similar to this one. Do they have any insights, any new interpretations, mm-hmm. even an appreciation of his work?
It's funny. And I saw a lot of parallels between the Pollock book and this one in the sense that I think they basically read Van Gogh as Pollock. They make him out to be a drunk who couldn't draw. Both of them. That was the Pollock book. Mm-hmm. Pollock always had a lot of trouble with draftsmanly facility. And he found a way to overcome that by dripping paint. With Van Gogh, they also argue that he could not draw realistically or not as well as other artists. He lacked the fluidity of his contemporaries, but somehow found a way around it by devising a style of his own.
Now, Deborah, they also advance a theory about Van Gogh's death,
yes,
which
do.
Has received much attention. So tell us about that.
Yes, they claim in the book that Van Gogh was probably murdered instead of having died alone in a wheat field as the result of a bullet wound administered by himself. In other words, they take on the theory of his suicide and claim that there were a group of teenagers in the south of France, in the town of Auvers, where he was living at the end of his life, who actually arrived one day to harass him and had a gun, and the gun fired, perhaps accidentally.
Do they have any evidence for this?
It's hearsay. It's based on the account of a man who lived in the town when Lust for Life came out with Kirk Douglas.
The popular movie.
Exactly. Yeah. That came out, I think, in around 54.
Mm-hmm.
And this man spoke up at that time. He knew Van Gogh. This man had been in the town. And when he saw Van Gogh portrayed by Kirk Douglas, he was so appalled and jealous that he came forth with a whole different version of Van Gogh's death and tried to insert himself into it. The theory has been floating around certainly since the 50s, and it has been available to every scholar who has worked on Van Gogh since. And it's interesting that every scholar has chosen to ignore it or dismiss it as so much hearsay.
And do they have an answer to those scholars, or they simply say they believe this one witness?
No, they don't really take on other scholars. And I think that's an interesting question. To me, that was an absence in the book. I wanted them to write about other research on Van Gogh. There has been so much, obviously, over the years. And I think that's an interesting question. Are biographers obligated to acknowledge the work of other scholars?
Now, Deborah, you have said Van Gogh is the greatest Dutch painter since Rembrandt. You're really good at this kind of assessment. What is his influence today?
Oh, please. Van Gogh, probably the most influential artist who ever lived.
Why?
Well, an art historian might say he was the greatest colorist who ever lived, but you could also say he was a great draftsman. Art historians are divided over whether his achievement was in terms of drawing or color. That's a very small achievement, of course. You look at his paintings, you feel like he's bringing something up from the bottom that nobody else does. It's not just surface. It's a beautiful surface. He has beautiful colors. No one used yellow like Van Gogh. But more than that, you do feel like there is something plus paint, paint plus in his pictures. That's very hard to define.
And how about Van Gogh, I hate to use this word, but the icon, the sort of symbol of the ignored genius who nonetheless carried. So he was only 37 when he died, who has this vision that he stays true to despite the obstacles. Is that something that matters to artists today?
Well, I tend to like artists. Some people would say it's all a racket. People just make art that they think will have the best chance of advancing their careers and getting them a show. But I don't think anybody becomes an artist in order to get ahead in the world. I mean, there are easier routes if you want to make money and have a big name. So I do think that artists are all in this because of some desire to stand alone and say something that hasn't been said before and put something into the world, an object into the world that is not like any other object. So in that sense, I think Van Gogh is an enormous hero for anybody who has tried to do something they believe in and not been supported by their peers. He was superior to the people around him who never gave him the time of day. And I think we can all relate to that to some degree, geniuses and non-geniuses alike.
Thanks so much, Deborah. That's Deborah Solomon, who reviews Van Gogh, The Life, in this week's book review. We are delighted to welcome back Gina Belafonte, who has been running or orchestrating the Big City Book Club. Hi, Gina.
Hi, Sam.
So what book are you doing now?
We are going to do Breakfast at Tiffany's for Tuesday, November 29th. You can catch the online conversation between 1 and 4, and we're really excited about it.
Okay, so tell us again exactly how this works. Are you the moderator?
I'm the moderator. I select the books. It's a bit autocratic. I post my thoughts the morning of the discussion or the day before, and then I invite readers to join me for an online chat around lunchtime and to weigh in with their thoughts. And I'm there moderating and arguing back.
And so you'll do it. Now, it's really almost a novella.
It's a novella.
So how much time will you do this, over a week?
No. We're just, sometimes the discussion does go over the time frame for the online chat. It's 1 to 4. Usually there are 3-hour discussions.
It's just 1 day. It's just one day then.
Yes,
that you're doing.
It's an afternoon. Okay. It's 1 to 4. But people who are not free during that time can weigh in on read the comments in the evening, weigh in then, and I check in periodically during the week.
So now it's probably impossible for you to assess who your readers are. But are you getting a mix of people, say, for whom Breakfast at Tiffany's is their Bible, others who've never read it before but always meant to?
That's why we chose the book, because so many people, of course, have read it. So many people are familiar with the movie, and this gives them a chance to read the book, which, of course, is quite different in tone. And so we're hoping to find new readers, young readers, and people who are revisiting it and who've read it.
Well, Ms. Book Club moderator, now that you've introduced the differences in tone between the novel and the movie, people will remember Audrey Hepburn, this very charming gamin in the movie.
Right.
And it is kind of a Hollywood film from its era. Kind of walk us through the book. When was the novel published? In the 50s, right?
The novel was published in 58. The movie, I believe, was 61. And the studio, of course, found the idea of a cheerful, jovial prostitute pretty unpalatable. And there was early discussion, interestingly, of Marilyn Monroe playing the part.
Of Holly Golightly, the heroine.
And the thinking was, Marilyn wasn't believable as a prostitute. So, of course, they really scotched the whole explicit prostitute idea. And we have the very sort of beautiful but asexual Audrey Hepburn in the role.
Right. That with Marilyn Monroe, the point would not be missed. So when one rereads this novel, now I'm a Capote fan.
Okay.
I don't know if you are.
Yes.
Some people maybe, some people may not. How does it hold up? This is more than half a century now.
I read it, I think, for the first time about 15 years ago, and then again recently, and it's wonderful and spare and very melancholy. And I was very moved by it again.
It's quite a picture of Manhattan at a certain moment.
It's a picture of Manhattan, of course, in the Mad Men era. So we hope to get Mad Men fans reading it who haven't. It is timeless, and that people are always coming here and trying to reinvent themselves and failing.
And tell us who Holly is.
Holly is a delightful, pretty Southern girl, Lulu May, who comes up to make herself in the big city, as so many have before and so many have since. And of course, it's very hard. It's a tough life here, and she is a in the movie describes her as an escort. The movie has her just going out for fun with wealthy men, and of course, in the book, we know she's a prostitute.
Jean, something that's memorable about Breakfast at Tiffany's is that although it's about the heroine of the novella is Holly Golightly, it's really told through other eyes. It's somebody else who's telling the story, a little bit like Nick Carraway in The Great Gatsby.
Right.
And Capote, who was a master technician and craftsman, chooses a character. We barely even know his name, but he is at the center of the story. And what kind of person is he? How does he know Holly Golightly? What's their relationship?
He is a friend, and he is observing her life with a certain close, intimacy and distance. And we see Holly's relationships and sadness through his eyes.
You said that Holly, in some sense, is Capote himself, who also came from the South and then moved to New York. But the narrator is too, in some ways, isn't he? That kind of naivete freshness.
Yes, that's what they share, is this outsider status in New York.
And who are some of the other characters who populate this story? Her clients.
There are her clients, Holly's lovers. And of course, in the movie, she ends up happily ever after with one of these lovers, which is not the case. I'm not giving away. I don't want to give away too much in the strict plot sense. But it is not a happily ever after story in the book, which is, of course, another problem that the studio had when they were making the movie.
Well, they still do. Hollywood likes to twist things around.
Right.
So when will you be doing this?
We will be doing this Tuesday, November 29th, so everyone can spend their Thanksgiving weekend reading the book. It's short. It won't take too much time.
And it's a masterpiece.
It really is a masterpiece. And I think, many people probably are only familiar with In Cold Blood. I bet many people have not read the fiction. There isn't much of it, but it's great.
Thanks so much, Jinya.
Thanks.
That's Jinya Belafonte, who moderates the Big City Book Club in the New York Times. This week's issue of the Book Review features an essay on audiobooks by the Times' own great legal correspondent, John Schwartz, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, John.
Thanks.
All right, so you've got to let people know, it's almost like a confession, you are a huge audiobooks guy. When did you start listening to them?
It was about 5 years ago. I was starting to exercise, starting to run most every day, and I was getting bored with my music and picked up an audiobook, first for a long, long drive, and then as I exercised, and it's been no looking back.
So is this now the main way you read? And I feel like I'm saying that in a sarcastic way, and I don't mean to, but is this the way you now get your fill of novels and
such? I get a lot more pages read through my ears than through my eyes these days, though I always have a book going as well.
Now, you mentioned some pretty serious fiction that you've listened to in audiobooks. David Mitchell is one of the novelists. You're a huge fan of Patrick O'Brien. Can you get the full experience by listening to it?
Well, I think I can, and this has been a little bit of a source of tension between me and my wife, because I think I'm getting the whole story. My wife thinks that I'm only half getting it, and we've gone back and forth on this. But I think I've shown over time in our discussions of the books that, in fact, I do get it. Now, it could be partly that I listen for a living, and I'm used to keeping a lot of stuff in my head. So it seems to me I'm wired for audiobooks.
But you also say, John, that when you were a college student, you got more from lectures than from reading. That's true for a lot of people.
That's exactly right. And so if it comes in through my ears, I get it. And people like my wife, and there are a lot of them, just think that reading means holding a book and looking at it.
Now, because you're a great reporter, you did some reporting, some really fun reporting for this essay. So tell us who you talked to.
That's right. I called Howard Gardner, who's a professor of cognition at Harvard and a terrific guy, and has developed this very famous theory of multiple intelligences. And in that theory, it says that that we're not just one type of intelligence. We don't have one type of smarts that shows up on the IQ test, that it's a varied thing. And there's linguistic intelligence. There's mathematical intelligence. There's a sort of body intelligence, how we use our bodies in space, interpersonal things, and that each of these is a different tuning to the world. And so there's not just one simple form of intelligence. And I wanted to know and sent him a note asking, is it possible that some of us are more wired for audiobooks than others?
And what did he say?
Well, first of all, in sending him the note, asking him if I could do the interview, I described my own situation at home with my wife, who is a book reader, and myself as an audiobook listener. And he said, well, that's very funny, because he described a situation in his home where he's the book guy and his wife, Ellen Winner.
She's kind of a big shot, too.
Well, exactly right. She's Ellen Winner, and she's chairman of the psychology department at Boston College. So so we're talking about a big gun couple, and that she is an audiobook listener, and he's the book reader.
So then what happened?
Well, he said, you really should talk to both of us. Call at home tonight. And they both got on extensions, and we had a conversation about it.
And what happened? What'd they have to say? Is it at all similar, parallel to the situation with you and your wife?
It sounded like the conversations I have with my wife on any given evening. Not only did we discuss why each of us felt strongly about the way we read, the way we listen, but there was a little bit of defensiveness creeping into it, that each of them was defending a position and feeling a little bit of heat, it seemed to me. And so it was very much like a night at home at my house.
And so, John, you go on to say in the essay then that the way someone chooses to read or is most comfortable reading is not really an abstract choice. It is somehow tied in with your identity, with the perceptions other people have of you, ideas, longstanding ideas about what constitutes reading and the like.
That's right. It's part of who we are. And when you criticize how you read, you're criticizing me. And so I get a little defensive about that, and I think anybody would. But it's also it's a little window into how each of us views the world.
Now, one last question, John. When you called Professor Gardner and spoke with him and Professor Winner, you asked about research being done in the field. What did they have to say about that?
Well, Professor Gardner suggested I might have given his wife the next study topic.
All right. That's what we do here at the New York Times Book Review. Thanks a lot, John.
You bet.
That's John Schwartz, whose essay Wired for Sound appears in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
How much time do you have?
Well, let's do it.
On the nonfiction side, it's almost half new books. Most of them are the usual celebrity memoirs. You've got Shaquille O'Neal's Shaq Uncut. You've got Gabrielle Giffords, her book with her husband. She, of course, is the congresswoman who was shot out in Arizona. Her book is called Gabby. That's new at number 6 on the list. Regis Philbin's How I Got This Way, an account of his television career. Also new on the list on the nonfiction side of things is Imperfect Justice, a look at the Casey Anthony case that debuts at number 3. And Diane Keaton's celebrity memoir, Then Again.
That's kind of an interesting book, isn't it?
It's interesting. It gives just enough of her Hollywood gossip to keep you reading, but it's largely a tribute to her mother. Dorothy Hall. I didn't realize that Diane Keaton's real last name is Hall, and her mother called her Annie. So, Annie Hall was Diane Keaton. The book is interesting because her mother kept copious journals throughout her life, and Keaton quotes from them pretty liberally in the book. And so it turns into more than just your treacly kind of boilerplate tribute to a parent like Tim Russert did with his father. This really gives you a real intimate sense of her mother. Her mother wrote these very interior, kind of searching profiles of herself and of her life, and you get those in the book.
What about fiction?
On the fiction side of things, there are 4 new books, including a Star Wars novel, and then 3 suspense or crime thrillers. Devil's Gate, a Clive Cussler book, is new at number 5. Then V for Vengeance, the next entry in Sue Grafton's Alphabet series of mysteries, is new at number 3.
She's running out of letters.
I know. She'll have to start going to numbers. James Patterson has the new number 1 book on the list. He debuts at number 1 with Kill Alex Cross.
Sorry, I'm not familiar with that name, James Patterson.
Well, what's funny, I write about this in my column this week, is that James Patterson, of course, is on the list all the time. He first hit the list with his Alex Cross book back in the 90s, book called Along Came a Spider. And since then, he's just gone on this tear. He actually has 2 books on the list this week. At number 1 is Kill Alex Cross, the suspense novel. And at number 9, he has a book called The Christmas Wedding. It's a romance book that he co-wrote. And he's been writing romances since 2001. So he has this kind of his and her bestsellers on the list simultaneously.
Boy, he's got the system down.
He really does.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.